I'm Josh. This is Dharmapunks New York. Everything I do is supported entirely by donation, the counseling and the teaching. The Venmo is Dharmapunks with an X NYC. And on the DharmapunksNYC.com website, there's Patreon and other buttons if you'd like to support my work. So thanks for that. And tonight, going to be talking about how we can best help support other people. Sometimes in counseling, people ask me, what is the best way when we're confronted with individuals who are suffering, distressed, going through difficult times, and we're caught in a situation where we don't know what to say? What is the best way to be of support someone that we care about or other beings that we feel compassion towards? So tonight we're going to explore this topic. I hope it's a good one. I suppose the best place to start is, as usual, reminding us that from the moment we're born, we use body movements, sounds, cries, and eventually eye contact and touch to signal to our caregivers, to signal our need for connection. And when the parents are able to recognize all these gestures, these movements, these cries, essentially these emotional impulses, they respond by picking us up and holding us, soothing. A mirror with eye contact. They, in turn, what this does, more than even protecting the infant, this signaling by the baby of its needs for connection and the parent responding, it regulates the baby's autonomic nervous system, which is literally determines pretty much everything about our state of being. When we are in distress, our autonomic nervous system shifts from homeostasis up into the kind of like mobilization states, sometimes known as fight, flight, fear, fawn, and freeze. So we go up into this kind of alert state. And when we're in that state, it's not particularly healthy. Our blood, our hormones, endocrine system releases cortisol. Our heart rate accelerates. And if this happens too frequently in child life, there's the amygdala becomes hypersensitive, and over the course of life, we then become individuals that are extremely reactive, hypersensitive, and of course prone to long-term disorders. And so it's a good thing that an infant can transmit through nonverbal means its internal states. When it's no longer comfortable, it signals through all these various forms of gesturing and cries. And when the baby is soothed by the parent, then the baby is returned to homeostasis or to ventral parasympathetic, and that allows the baby to sleep, to digest, to, if the baby is awake, then it can explore the environment without too much fear or anxiety, and it can begin to bond with other adults and so forth. So there's a lot of really positive outcomes that derive from parents that can recognize the nonverbal cues by their infants and address whatever the infant is signaling, whether it's food, warmth, being held, reducing stimuli, or just the sense of being connected with and seen in the eyes of the other. So as a child grows to become increasingly verbal around the ages of 2 or 3 or 4, parents, additionally to these nonverbal responses, start to label the child's emotional state. So if the child is throwing a tantrum or a fit and yelling and stomping about and demanding attention, the parents will say, "Oh, you're angry." And then after that, they might mirror the expression of anger. And then they'll smile to say everything's okay. So the child understands what their feelings, what emotion they're experiencing, and they can integrate this emotion of anger into their self structure. When parents don't label their child's emotions or shun their children when they have certain emotional states, then the child grows up with emotions that are not integrated, and those emotional states or feelings feel foreign and dangerous and need to be immediately suppressed by any means. And of course, if there's too many emotions that are shunned, then the child might wind up relying on substances or addictions to regulate these emotions because their parents didn't simply help the child integrate the emotional states into their self structure. So nonverbal transmission, nonverbal signaling of our internal states to other brains continues throughout our life. And it's more than just regulating our nervous system. It's a constant stream of nonverbal facial expressions where we attain and lose eye contact, where people turn towards us and away. And all of these subtle cues inform us how to act. When to change a subject, when we're speaking too much or too little, when to approach a group of people or when to stay away. So we call that in adult life reading the room. And reading the room, or, you know, picking up on the cues, is so vital for our ability to sustain friendships, to participate in social gatherings. And it's a process that requires so many, or consumes so much of our brain's resources. I mean, to accurately read a nonverbal cue and to turn it into something that will guide our behavior in such a way that will be accepted by others, you need to have a working prefrontal cortex to regulate responses. You need a fusiform gyrus to accurately see the signals. You need an anterior cingulate cortex to warn you if people are turning away or are your bonds are being frayed. You need an amygdala. You need a superior temporal sucleus to actually make sense of it. So you're using up all these circuits just to make sense of nonverbal cues. And it's such a vital process that it's done unconsciously, which are the fastest circuits of the brain. If we were responsible for interpreting nonverbal cues that are being sent to us consciously, we'd never be able to speak, because all of our attention and all of our cognitive effort would go into just unpacking and trying to figure out what people's facial expressions, their tone of voice, their body language, their hand gestures, and so forth. What does it all mean? So it's an unconscious process known as neuroception. And it's governed, as we know from the work of Alan Shore and Dan Siegel, more about them in a moment, that this process is almost exclusively right hemispheric. We're unaware of reading other people's nonverbal cues. All we know is that, at best, is that certain shifts in other people's body language, tone of voice, the way they look at us, can then create in us different states of being. So we're unconsciously reading all these signals. We're not aware of it. And we're transmitting our internal states at the same time. The reason why we're unaware of this process is not only because it demands the resources of the fastest circuits of our right hemisphere, but as adults, our dominant hemisphere is the left hemisphere that provides language. So we're off thinking our thoughts, listening to what people say, and responding to what people say. That's what our conscious attention is devoted to. But as I'm talking to you right now, and your left hemispheres are trying to figure out what the hell I'm rambling about, your right hemispheres are listening to my tone of voice, monitoring your environment. They're looking at my facial expressions, and they're just solving some very basic questions like, am I safe? Do I feel an emotional sense of connection? Can I relate to any of this on a experiential basis? The psychologist Mehrabian, I think his first name was Albert Mehrabian, found that communication is 55% body language, that is eye contact, smiling, hand gestures, 38% vocal, and that's not words, that's just the tone of voice, pauses, shifts of inflection, and 7% of communication is the things we actually say, the words. This is why text-based communication is to be shunned entirely, because you're only getting 7% of the information somebody's actually sending to you. You don't actually get to see their facial expressions and their body language and their tone of voice when they're writing you, nor do they see yours. So text-based communications are just rife with misunderstandings because we're not getting 93% of the information that we would get if we were, for instance, on, I don't know, FaceTime or Google Meet, or actually, God forbid, in person with each other. So it's through nonverbal signals that our core self is expressed. We actually have two self-images. One that's consciously maintained by our thoughts, our left hemisphere, which is basically a story. And it's just a story of, you know, a list of our jobs, our skills, important events. But it doesn't reflect core emotional themes like, fear of inadequacy, grief, shame, unmet needs, traumas, emotional wounds. All of those memories are maintained in an unconscious self structure that's comprised of feelings in the body and unconscious images. And these are unspoken memories. And so if you want to really be known by another, your core self cannot be conveyed by representational language. And this is definitely why some of the most profound experiences are listening to music and looking at art, because these are nonverbal ways of expressing internal states. And while I'm not giving short shrift to novels and poetry, which can disclose people's thoughts that they generally keep hidden, but the most evocative transmission of internal states happens through nonverbally, through nonverbal means. In our adult life, as our left brains become so dominant and processes everything through language, it begins to believe that thought is really the only, the words we say and the our thoughts are the only thing that really matters. In fact, Descartes so bought into this that he said, I think, therefore I am. Basically, he believed the spirit was simply one's thoughts, not one's emotions, feelings, trace memories, one's routines, one's anxieties, but just our language-based thoughts. The great clinical researcher John Gottman showed in his with his amazing research where he examined what he called bids for attention, showed that most of the time when people start speaking to another person, while they believe it's to share an idea or to talk about something important or to discuss a plan or to resolve an issue, that in fact, it's simply a bid for attention. We're trying to reestablish attachment. A vocal utterance is simply at its root saying, here I am, I need to feel seen by you to be reassured that our attachment is still secure. That's ultimately why we connect with each other, for that being seen in the eye of another, having somebody emotionally mirror what we're conveying. Sadly, in late stage capitalism, parents are so overburdened by getting their kids fed, to school, to soccer practice, and solving problems, they forget how to stop everything and simply pay attention to their children and just say, oh, you're feeling sad, or you're feeling angry or frustrated. That's okay. I'm here. You know, I'm with you. So children's emotional statements are pretty soon seen as issues to be solved and fixed, not simply to be connected with. This is what's known as functional communication. It's not emotional communication, it's functional. In adult life, because we've experienced growing up so many times our parents just trying to fix and solve our issues rather than to stop and pay attention and simply listen and allow us to be in a state, we tend to gravitate towards functional communication ourselves with our family members, our friends, our work colleagues. When somebody's in distress, we think what the situation demands is being smart or funny or useful, fixing whatever the issue is. And so we immediately try to remove the emotion rather than to simply acknowledge the emotion and stay with the emotion as a witness to it. And it's, you know, so difficult for us to remember that at root, helping others is not a logical process involving fixing or solving, but it's actually a bearing witness of staying with. It's not thought-based, but orienting towards someone, listening, asking questions, mirroring as much as we can what we're hearing, conveying safe and encouraging body language. And the more we do this, as people who care about others, the more we practice focusing on people's the body language, the tone of voice, the when people are making eye contact or not, and the more we bring attention to it and even note it, I can hear in your voice, I can see from that it's difficult to, you know, for us to make eye contact, I can feel in the way we're sitting ajar to each other that this is a difficult experience for you. So when others are upset, lonely, sad, frightened, disappointed, providing solutions trying to cheer people up, trying to reason people down. No matter how noble the intentions, it doesn't alleviate the distress most of the time. In fact, it almost invariably misses entirely what the other person needs. Again, verbal utterances are bids for attention. It's simply one individual's nervous system reaching out to ours. And if we don't get that enough, where people see our internal states and just allow us to express it and note it, then we experience what's called emotional loneliness, which is different from social loneliness, which is the absence of a community that we belong to. Emotional loneliness is the absence of a small group of core attachment figures that understand what we're going through, what our emotional states, what our fears are, what we're concerned about. A famous evolutionary psychologist, Robin Dunbar, like a giant in the field, he gave an interview at one point to the New Yorker, and he said that when you look through different cultures, you see that transculturally, transhistorically, people have generally had in their clans or tribes what he called A, B, and C, or something like A, B, and C people. An A person is like the person that you might be in a relationship with, or might be a best friend or a caregiver or whatever. A C person is just all the people you know and are friendly with, but B people are a small group of individuals that know what you're going through on an emotional level, that you disclose our pain, our shame, our sadness, our disappointments. And he noted that in today's late stage capitalism, it's the B people that most of us are missing, that small group of emotion co-regulators. So one of my many, many heroes in the field of 21st century psychology are the figures Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow. They were major figures in what's called humanistic psychology. And they shifted the emphasis from the idea of people are carriers of problems that need to be solved by interpretations or symptoms that need to be addressed, like a doctor removing a symptom. And they simply posited that people simply needed a facilitator, someone who would be there to listen, to acknowledge, to let the client direct the process, to let the therapist would simply listen with interest to what was being said. And even when it seemed misguided or bizarre or angry, the therapist wouldn't at first intervene or address the challenges. They'd simply acknowledge the emotions and the difficulty that the client was experiencing. And then they would ask, what do you need right now? They'd let the client direct whether the client was ready for a solution or another way to frame the experience. But they wouldn't just come at the client and say, okay, you're looking at this the wrong way, or you're not finding the obvious way out. And they would provide, things like unconditional positive regard, they called it, to their clients, accepting their clients without judgment, interrogation, interruption, reproach. And they both were very attuned to the idea that our unconscious selves, our sense of self, was shaped during childhood. And that children who felt they had to earn love and approval ended up with low self-esteem. feelings of unworthiness, and often compensated in adult life by seeking love in the wrong places. So they believe that the way to create the healing experience was to provide the corrective emotional experience, where they offered their clients what they didn't get in childhood. It's very similar to Winnicott and Bowlby's theories of, attachment parenting and what the role of the therapist. And finally, Rogers had a fascinating insight. He said, when our conscious story of who we are doesn't line up at all with our internal feelings, when we don't disclose or have people that know what we're feeling and can recognize it, and when we're only trying to present to the world this image that's without flaws, without faults, without difficult emotions, the lack of coherence between our conscious self-state and our unconscious self-state is the cause of anxiety. Anxiety, Rogers believed, was what happens when there's parts of self that we haven't disclosed to other people, and have these parts of self haven't been seen or recognized, not solved or fixed, just simply seen and recognized. So in acknowledging, not interrupting, not judging, asking questions, he found that the reduction of distress and significant progress in the therapeutic bond happens so much faster than in the kind of traditional cognitive behavioral therapy approaches, where he challenged other people's thoughts and tried to fix the way they were thinking about experience. So I think in Rogers' approach, we can all learn how to provide support. It's not about having to provide wonderful insights or fix situations that we may or may not have any insight with. Most of the time, I've come to realize I don't. It's not about doing anything other than creating a safe environment for someone to express through words and through nonverbal means what they're going through, and acknowledging that. This was so important to the Buddha. In his teachings on Kalyanamitta, wise spiritual friends, he was at one point in the Upada Sutta asked by Ananda, Ananda asks, is it true that admirable close friends are half of the holy life? And the Buddha said, never say that. It's the whole of the holy life. It's only with close Kalyanamitta, wise spiritual friends who understand us, that we can make any spiritual progress. And in the Mita Sutta, he said that it's essential that we cultivate wise friends, so who will endure our pain and difficult words, who share their secrets while keeping ours safe, who won't desert us, who won't judge or shame. So in essence, he's basically repeating the almost word for word Carl Rogers approach to humanistic psychology. And finally, this is why in the 10 daily recollections, three of the recollections are all about just bringing to mind people that would understand and could recognize our internal states without any shame or judgment or disdain. The three practices are called Buddha Nusati, which is recollecting the Buddha, a figure who sees all and sees in all beings the possibility of enlightenment. Sangha Nusati, which is recollection of our spiritual support, any community that we belong to, and Deva Nusati, which is recollection of any beings, people that have been protective or beneficial or cared about us, who have seen and still expressed love or unconditional friendliness to us. So if you'd like to learn more about this, probably the best place to start would be today, would be learning a little bit more about right brain to right brain psychotherapy and interpersonal neurobiology. You could just simply look at some of the summary of the work of Alan Shore or Dan Siegel, who are kind of pioneers in showing how what individuals need in therapy is not, and primarily nonverbal, eye contact, connection, a safe container where they feel truly seen. Diana Fosha's emotion-focused AEDP. And then there's a lot of others, like people like that are integrating interpersonal or right brain to right brain psychotherapy into it. Or you could just read the work of Carl Rogers, D.W. Winnicott, John Bowlby, or just keep it simple and reflect on the Buddhist teachings of how much we need people that don't fix or solve, but just see us unconditionally with metta, karuna, and mudita, kindness, compassion, and appreciation. So that's tonight's talk. And I hope something was of value. And so what I'm going to do is lead a meditation where we practice the tools of recollecting and creating an internal model or image of individuals, or the sense that we are known by others, because even the sense that we are known is, as a priming tool, is beneficial for our well-being. So thanks for listening. And if you now can find a comfortable seated position off screen, so you don't have to be looked at while you're meditating, or any kind of contemplative practice that you want. And just taking this time to find a comfortable place to sit and in the tradition I practice in and was taught in, the Theravadin tradition, we close our eyes, but you don't have to. I find closing my eyes makes it easier for me to bring attention to my internal state. And given that's what tonight's talk was about, internal states being conveyed, known, appreciated, closing one's eyes is probably the best way to let go of our distraction by the world around us and bring our attention to feelings and body sensations. So bring your attention to someplace in your body that feels safe, spacious, free of discomfort. For me, I like to land my attention very often in my hands, just completely inhabit the space between the palm and the back of the hand, the fingers. For some reason, I generally find my hands to be a comfortable place to land. And then find another space in your body, maybe the belly, behind the eyes, somewhere in the legs, that you can just inhabit, filling out all the internal space of some area. And we do this so that we can become comfortable with simply interoception, which means an ongoing awareness of our internal state. And if you like, at this point, bring awareness to some area of the body that feels a little constricted, maybe some muscles that feel needlessly tight. Sometimes I find that in the neck or the shoulders. And use the breath, your awareness of breathing in and out, to see if you can soothe some. One way to do this is just to find an area nearby that feels comfortable. And just with the in-breath, imagine the comfort from the nearest area to the body, to the discomfort being brought in and releasing the tension. And then with the out-breath, returning back to the source of ease. So breathing through any tension. So at this point, find an area of your body that's associated with breathing in, the area associated with breathing out. And just ride the energy back and forth. For me, it's the in-breath I feel in my belly. The energy moves up from the belly to the chest, like a wave coming to shore, and then the energy being released. The exhalation, the energy goes back down from the chest to the abdomen. So breathing in and out is like riding waves to shore and back. Now, if you like, bring to mind an image, any image that is right for you of an enlightened being that is truly peaceful. A being that, without in any way being reactive, frustrated, that you could display any feeling to, and this being would simply wish you kindness and compassion, as well as delight at times you experience well-being. This doesn't have to be an image of the Buddha that you've seen. In fact, it's better if you cultivate your own image that resonates for you. And if you can cultivate an image of any enlightened figure, what would you, in complete safety, without any judgment or fear of any criticism, what would you want, what feeling, memory, concern would you want to be known? What would you wish other people would know about how you feel? And then cultivate an image of any person or being that you've felt unconditional kindness or friendliness or real concern from. If no one comes to mind, just cultivate an image in your head of what such a angelic devata would be like. And again, if any memory or feeling or concern, impulse, you could share with this non-judgmental, profoundly kind and compassionate being, what would that emotion, impulse, or memory be? What needs attention? Lastly, for Sangha Nusati, if you could bring to mind yourself in it, a community or a small group of people where you feel safe, people who would just see you as belonging and a member, that you wouldn't have to ever prove yourself. Just conjure up that image of belonging, whether or not you've actually known it. Just create a visual sense of what that would be like. So at this point, I'm going to bring the practice to a close and just take your time bringing your attention back to the world around you.